This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now your host, Rick Moore.
Hey, good morning, everyone. Thank you for listening to WNRN. Today's program is supported by Dixon Disposal, family-owned and operated for 40 years. Dixon Disposal works to promote green awareness. Dixon offers all-in-one can recycling, so you won't have to spend time sorting or trying to figure out which items are recyclable. These recyclable items won't end up in the landfill, so for more information on the all-in-one can recycling, it's DixonDisposal.com or call them 978-2111. All right, our guest today, Professor Brad Wilcox. He's from UVA's Department of Sociology, and he's the director of the National Marriage Project. We're going to talk about marriage, relationships, and parenting. Professor, good morning.
It's good to be here, Rick. Good morning.
Thank you for coming in. No Christmas shopping yet today?
Not yet. No, not yet.
That's where I should be. Let me talk to you. The National Marriage Project.
Yes.
Can you tell a little bit, tell folks exactly what that's all about?
The National Marriage Project started in 1997 with David Papineau and Barbara Whitehead at Rutgers. And David actually retired about 3 years ago in 2009 and passed the baton on me down here at UVA. And we've got three goals. One is to monitor the health of marriage in America. One is to understand the social and cultural forces affecting married life in the United States. And the third is to try to figure out how we can strengthen marriages in the U.S.
Well, as I'm doing my homework on marriages, I run into a variety of articles written by you on the board of the National Marriage Project. By the way, it's nationalmarriageproject.org. And some of the feedback or people questioning the articles,
sure.
Talking about, the stand of what the National Marriage Project is. So I want to ask you a couple quick questions for listeners to have this as information as we go forward. Are you married?
Yes, I am.
And do you have children?
I do have kids, yes.
And your religious background, are you a strong faith in one particular religious?
Yes, I am Catholic, but I certainly would view this project as non-sectarian.
All right, thank you.
And our board, I should say, has Catholics, Protestant, Jews, and agnostic members on the advisory board.
Okay, good to know. And I think listeners should remember that throughout the hour, because some of my questions challenge articles about their focus and standpoint. One of the most, inviting is the right word, but one of the questions that I found that immediately got me to stand up is parenting an obstacle to good marriage?
Well, yeah, it's a good question.
I mean, that's one of the articles
that's right.
Actually on the National Marriage Project,
sure.
Board.
Right. So basically what we find is that there is a dip in marital happiness for people who are parents. And it looks like from the longitudinal research that kind of dip goes away as people move through their lives and as kids tend to leave the nest. But there certainly is a hit that many couples take when the first child comes along. And what's interesting is it's usually around that first child and not the second or third kid. It's really that first child that sort of shocks the marital system, if you will.
This is WNRN. Sunday morning wake-up call. I'm Rick Moore talking with our guest today, Professor Brad Wilcox. He's the director of the National Marriage Project, also a professor of sociology here at UVA. This is also a thank you out to those folks listening on Harrisonburg's 95.1. So, Professor, we're talking about parenting as a possible obstacle to good marriage, and you're saying that really only is, I think you said, shock to the system for the first,
child. Yeah, and everything I'm going to say this morning is sort of talking to you about kind of what's the typical pattern. What we see in many couples is that when the first child comes along, you know, it's a major shock. I mean, you're staying up late at night. Oftentimes, you've got the wife who's sort of working less in the short term, at least. Husband's working more. There's just a lot of changes that are happening that can be stressful for, you know, your average couple. But it's also important to note that not every couple experiences it as a strain on their marriage. Some actually do better in the wake of the arrival of the first child. But that typically it's that first kid who really kind of upsets and upends the marriage, and then they kind of adjust and move forward.
Is that a challenge in the way where children may be better in some situations being raised by one parent? I mean, when you talk about a shock to the system, and then you say it's okay, or I guess sort of lessons learned for a second extra other children, is this where in some situations you may be better off having one parent?
Well, certainly in some situations that's going to be the best situation, and I was raised by a single mom and she did a pretty good job, but on average, people are more likely to handle parenthood successfully when they're married. We find, for instance, in a report last year that single parents, both men and women, are more likely to be depressed compared to married parents, and they're much less likely to report that they're happy. We have to sort of hold on to this idea that on the one hand, yeah, it's stressful on your marriage to have a child, but it's a lot more stressful to be a parent without having a spouse there to help you along with that child.
Is that work if they're, you say when there's a spouse there, what if you're single but you have, you're a close family or you live in a smaller city or maybe you don't even live close to other family members being your parents or your siblings, but you have emotional support from family that may live further away through conversations daily, phone calls about lessons that, your mom and dad are teaching to you.
Well, I would say that generally having extended family and having friends involved in the parenting enterprise is a plus, and it makes it easier for any of us, whether we're married or single or whatnot. But on average, once again, it's easier to do this with someone else right there in the house, on the home front, day in and day out. That's certainly easier for most of us than doing it on our own.
We are talking about marriage, relationships, parenting with our guest today, Professor Brad Wilcox, also author of When Marriage Disappears, The New Middle America. Jump into that. I'm sure just because that's my distorted habit to float from one topic to another and not follow any sort of chain of conversation. By the way, if you want to throw in your question or comment to take me out of any floating around, 979-0919, 877-WNRN rocks. Your book, When Marriage Disappears, is marriage really disappearing?
So what we find in this new research is that marriage is in pretty good shape among Americans who are college educated and relatively more affluent. But by contrast, marriage is becoming a lot more fragile in communities, working class, lower middle class communities that up until about 10 or 20 years ago were doing pretty well on the marriage front. So here in Charlottesville, for instance, marriage would be relatively strong just geographically in most of Charlottesville and Albemarle County. But if you were to go to Greene County, about 15 miles north of here, or to Augusta County, or Louisa County, 50 miles east and west of Charlottesville, you would see that marriage is much more fragile. And the point here is that Americans who are high school educated or have just some college education are much more likely to get divorced nowadays, about three times more likely to get divorced than their college-educated peers, and they're much more likely to have their kids outside of wedlock, often in a cohabiting context, and that's a much less stable context for their kids. So what we're seeing is that marriage is losing ground, not among the college-educated set, really, as much as those who are just sort of a step below in our social class ladder here in the U.S.
All right, we'll get into that a little more detail as we go on. Marriage and relationships, what are some of the differences and challenges now versus in the past?
Well, I certainly think that one of the challenges facing, this goes to my most recent comment, one of the challenges facing many Americans is that we don't have the same stability when it comes to jobs as we used to. For most Americans, there's a lot more movement, there's a lot more unemployment, underemployment. And if a good job is a foundation for marriage, as it is still today, that presents many, many couples with challenges. But a second thing that certainly I think is the case is that we have much more flexible gender roles in the U.S. today than we did 50 years ago. And there's a lot of good about that. But one challenge that it creates for couples is they have to kind of navigate, childcare. They've got to navigate paid work. They've got to navigate cooking, cleaning without a script. And without sort of a way to handle it. So it makes it more incumbent upon today's couples to figure out how to do all this and to sort of have strong communication skills that can navigate the kind of flexibility and lack of sort of the lack of a script that confronts many contemporary couples.
You know, that's that brings forth about a dozen questions right there. When you say that lack of a script, was there a script in the past? You know, because when you say that, the image that pops into my head is Leave It to Beaver. You know, you talk about a script that takes me to a TV or a movie show,
sure.
Which takes me to, I guess, the roles that everyone was expected and almost designed to play.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Of course, I was born in 1970, so I actually haven't even seen these 50 shows that people talk about as sort of the typecast. But I can just sort of say, you know, that people in earlier epochs had a script. Now, the scripts actually varied, of course. If we were living, you know, 150 years ago in this very area, people would be primarily working on farms and working in small shops. And both, you know, husbands and wives would be working in some meaningful way, often in sort of, you know, in their kind of, in their enterprise as a family. But they sort of had a sense of, well, you know, I do this, he does that, or, you know, she does that, I do that. And today what I'm saying is there, you know, there's just no common pattern that people can kind of expect, and orient their lives around. And there's a lot of good things about that flexibility and that freedom. But it does, I think, create some challenges in terms, particularly as couples are setting up their households are setting up their families with kids, and they're sort of navigating these new relationships with their children that require them to figure out how are they going to, you know, handle paid work, childcare, cooking, cleaning in ways that they find to be both helpful and equitable.
You know, we're talking about a script. Is that the main piece of the changes and the difficulties between then and now?
That's part of it. I think probably the other big thing that I would say is that we've seen the rise of what's called expressive individualism in our culture.
Say that again.
Expressive individualism.
Expressive.
Yes. So people are trying to sort of seek more today, I think, than 50 years ago, lives that are kind of meaningful and fulfilling on their own individual terms. And they're trying to figure out how they can kind of meet their own desires and expectations as well as living in a marriage with someone who has his own or her own agenda. And without, once again, a sort of a clear script about how to navigate a spousal role, being a, you know, being a husband, being a wife. So one of the other challenges today, I think, is people are less likely to grant marriage itself as an institution a kind of primary importance in their lives, and they're more likely to kind of pursue what they think is important for themselves. And that, of course, can lead to conflict when you've got two spouses moving in different directions.
We are talking today with our guest, Professor Brad Wilcox from UVA's Department of Sociology, talking about marriage and parenting, relationships. You're welcome to call up with your question or comment, 979-0919, 877-WNRN Rocks. Let me take a moment and thank CVET for their support. Today's programming supported by WHTJ, Charlottesville's local PBS station. Information about PBS and local programming can be found at ideastations.org. That's WHTJ programming can be seen in the Richmond area on WCVE-TV. And thanks to them for their support. Professor Wilcox, and we're talking about then versus now. Can a couple, I'm assuming that couples can still find long-term happiness.
Yes, of course they can, and often do. In fact, most couples today who get married will not get divorced. That's not the same thing as happiness, but it's important to recognize. I think there's this sort of stat out there that half of American couples who get married today get divorced. It looks to us more like around 43% of couples who get married in their first marriages today will divorce.
Why would you have that difference in numbers? It seems like that would be a pretty simple question to ask with definitive numerical results.
Well, the challenge is we have to look at, you know, at life tables. There's basically two ways out of a marriage. One is divorce and one is death, right? And so for couples who are getting married today, you know, if they live until, you know, 83, for instance, we'd have to track them, you know, typically for about, you know, 50 years, basically. And so between, you know, now and 50 years from now, they could get divorced at some point, or they could go the distance. So it's about kind of tracking typical couples today and sort of seeing how stable they are, especially over the first 9 years in marriage when most divorces will occur. And, you know, based upon those kinds of trends, we can develop estimates for what we think will be the divorce rate for a typical couple. But it is a challenge given the fact that, you know, it's a successful marriage will last a long time today.
Well, so long-term happiness or long-term relationships are possible.
Yes.
But it seems that our culture is much more about immediacy.
Correct.
But you're saying that the numbers have not gone down but so much, but the change in our desires and our thought process has certainly changed to immediacy in a greater manner.
Well, there's good news and bad news about marriage in America today. The good news is that people who get married today are actually more likely to succeed than folks who got married in the 70s and 80s. And I kind of give this sort of political example, and that is that Newt Gingrich is sort of the, you know, the example of how things were sort of being screwed up in the 70s and 80s. And Barack Obama is an example, and Michelle Obama are an example of how things are succeeding today with marriages. It's not a partisan point. It's a generational point. And that is that back in the 70s and 80s, I think many people didn't take their marriages very seriously. And today, those who do marry, I think, often take their marriages seriously. And the biographical accounts of the, you know, of the Obamas suggest that there was a period, you know, in their early married life where there was some real tension there, and there, you know, there was some, you know, a lot of difficulty, but they obviously have persevered and seem happily married today. But it's also important for us, in terms of the bad news, to recognize that many Americans today are not getting married in the first place, and they're having kids as cohabiting couples, or just on their own. And it's that new reality, which is more common among Americans who don't have college degrees, who are working-class Americans, who are poor Americans. It's that new reality that personally, to me, is the most troubling trend that I see in marriage today.
All right, so let's talk about... You keep coming back to the part about social status.
Sure, right.
And what I heard, doesn't mean I heard it correctly, was that a wealthier level of individuals seem to have longer-lasting marriages. Not necessarily happier, but longer-lasting marriages. Is there a social status that requires that they need to stay married? Expectations socially or financially?
Well, I think what's happening is that, you know, many college-educated Americans aren't necessarily always wealthy, but who are well-educated have developed a sense, and it's often more of a tacit sense than an explicit sense, that, you know what, to sort of get married and stay married is the best thing for me and for my kids. If I want my kids to go to UVA, if I want my kids to go to James Madison University, if I want my kids to go to Harvard, for instance, you know, at some level they recognize that their kids' odds of succeeding in this world are going to be higher if they manage to get married and stay married in connection to having a family. And they're more likely to live in a decent home if they get and stay married. They're more likely to accrue wealth if they get and stay married. So I think that there's a certain way in which a kind of tacit wisdom has settled upon better educated, more affluent Americans since the divorce revolution of the 70s and early 80s. They've kind of learned the lesson. That's the point I make about the Obamas, is that, you know, that at some level, people like the Obamas have kind of learned the lesson that the best thing for them and for their kids is to forge, you know, forge a way through married life. That's not always easy, but it's worth it. Unfortunately, that same kind of recognition and the same kind of resources financially as well has not been with many working class and poor Americans. But I want to say it's both a cultural and an economic story, and I can unpack that if you want me to.
11:20 on the Wake Up Call. Our guest today, Professor Brad Wilcox, talking about parenting and relationships. 979-0919-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Markets of Tiger Fuel forecast. Chance of rain, 30% chance, high in the mid-50s today. Chance of rain tonight, cloudy and around 40. And then a slight chance of showers tomorrow, possible thunderstorms after 1 p.m., high about 69. Right now, 54 in the Valley, 56 in Lynchburg, 53 in Richmond, and 53 in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And today's programming on WNRN, also brought to you by Blue Ridge Graphics at Meade Avenue and East High Street here in Charlottesville. They provide custom T-shirts and sportswear, plus promotional items for schools, organizations, and businesses. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 434-296-9746. Online, it's BRG t-shirts.com. Back with our guest, Professor Brad Wilcox. He's the director of the National Marriage Project and also a professor of sociology here at UVA. We're talking about marriages and the benefits of staying married and the social status where that is more likely to happen. Is there, we keep talking about the social status and how those folks, is it that they seem to remain married or is it they choose to remain married? Which comes first, the personal decision to remain married or the outside factors that lead them to do so?
That's a great question. I think it's both. I mean, I think what we're seeing actually is that since the 70s, Americans who are college educated become more averse to divorce. They become more likely, since, to choose to stay married, through thick and thin. And that commitment to kind of a lifelong ethic of marriage sort of fuels them and guides them through the inevitable difficulties and challenges that married and life more generally presents to them. So that's part of the story. But it's also the case, too, that they have access to more resources. You know, they've got typically better jobs, less stressful jobs, more in savings. And those financial things and those, aspects of their employment make it easier for them to both to get married in the first place and to stay married in the second place. The bigger point here is that liberals tend to talk about economics and how economics are undercutting working class and poor families. And conservatives tend to talk about the cultural forces undercutting working class and poor families. And my own research suggested that both factors, the cultural changes of the last 50 years and the economic changes of the last 50 years, are both playing a role in explaining why it is that today in America, if you're college educated, you're likely to get and stay married and have kids in that context and have a stable family. And if you're not college educated, you're much more likely not to get married, and you're much more likely to experience a kind of relationship carousel where you're stepping on and off with different partners and your kids are experiencing instability.
Well, let's talk about economics for a second. It's certainly, even outside of today's hour, it's the topic of conversation throughout the news. How has the economy from the last few years affected marriage or relationships or parenting?
Well, in terms of the sort of the impact of the Great Recession, it looks like divorce took a slight hit in the direction of decline. There's debates about that. And there's also debates about why it's happened. Some people would say it's happened just because people are postponing divorces until they can kind of afford to get a divorce. They can afford those attorney's fees. They can afford two households, in the nine yards. It's also the case that some research that I've done suggests people have actually taken the Great Recession and the aftermath as sort of as an opportunity to kind of reflect upon how, they depend upon others. They depend upon their spouse. And, they're kind of going to recommit themselves to working through any difficulties that they might have. So I think the recession has kind of affected divorce, in two different ways in that respect. We've seen the marriage rate go down in the Great Recession and the aftermath. I think people are hesitant to make a big commitment until they have a strong financial footing upon which to stand for their marriage. And I think that's why the recession and its aftermath has also contributed to a decline in marriage. So those are two things we've seen in the wake of the Great Recession.
All right. We got a caller by phone, I guess, on the road. Laura from Exit 240. Question number one, has the National Marriage Project determined which is a more relevant indicator of staying together, education or marrying later in life?
Well, that's a great question. We find in our research that college-educated Americans are more likely to succeed, and that folks who wait to about 25 or later in life to get married are more likely to succeed when it comes to divorce. But I think education is a more powerful predictor of marital stability than is age at marriage.
And question two from Laura fits well into one of my questions is the National Marriage Project. If you go to nationalmarriageproject.org, I only see conversation about man plus woman equals children. Is that what the National Marriage Project is studying? Is there, because Laura's question is only talking about heterosexual marriage, or does research include same-sex marriage?
We have not yet focused on same-sex marriage, although I think that's probably going to be on, on our plate fairly soon. One of the challenges facing us is that we have relied upon large representative samples of American families to draw our conclusions. And in the larger population, there are very few same-sex couples out there who are either A, together, or, of course, B, married. And so right now it's relatively hard to study them. But I think as this, you know, as this issue kind of continues to percolate, there'll be more married same-sex couples for us to study in an easier format.
11:26 on the Wake Up Call, talking with UVA professor Brad Wilcox about the National Marriage Project studies about parenting and marriage. It's a nonprofit organization, correct?
We're just part of UVA, actually. So, and UVA is a nonprofit. So, yes, it's nonprofit.
So I'll ask this follow-up question.
Yes.
Is there any funding that says you will focus on, you will not focus on same-sex marriage?
No, we have conservative and liberal funders in the mix. And so there's no, there are no strings attached in terms of what we will or will not say or do.
Let me ask this. You wrote an article or somewhere on the National Marriage Project, I think it had your name attached, about put a ring on it.
Yeah.
You're talking about cohabitation versus actual marriage relationships.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Well, what we see, particularly for people who are who've got kids or who want to have kids, that cohabitation obviously gives people a lot more freedom and flexibility in their relationships. But the downside, the flip side of that reality, is that there's less commitment and there's less stability. And so in terms of, I was in a symposium in the New York Times on this question for folks who were considering kind of they had gotten divorced, what's next? Should they cohabit? Should they get, you know, married? And my point was, if you're going to have a relationship in the wake of a divorce, you should get married. I mean, your kids are going to need, you know, more stability, more security. The last thing they need is more instability in their lives. And the reality is that people who cohabit are much less likely to stay together than those who get married.
Whether it's true or not, I always thought about cohabitation as the learning time. Instead of dating someone for a year or two and then getting married and possibly missing on some key factors about whether you could actually be married and be together, cohabitation was a great time to determine exactly how long and the deepness of the relationship should go. Fair? Foul?
Well, you know, most research suggests that folks who cohabit prior to marriage are more likely to get divorced after marriage. Now, the big debate there, though, is in my field, is whether that's about what's called selection or causation. And it could be that the types of people who select into cohabitation are just less committed, less religious, less likely to go, you know, go the distance. And it's not cohabitation per se that poses a challenge to marriage. What I would say is I think that cohabitation is not the same thing as marriage. I mean, clearly, everyone would sort of acknowledge that. There's no ceremony required. There's no, you know, you don't register at the local county office. There's not the same level of commitment, of trust, of security. And so, yes, in some ways, it might give you a time of preparation, but because it really isn't the same thing as marriage, you know, it isn't allowing you to kind of, you know, in a sense, test drive the marriage because it's not a marriage. It's sort of like relationship between high school and college. I mean, there's similarities there between high school and college, but how you do in high school isn't necessarily a predictor of how you do in college because there is a kind of a different reality there in college, like there's a different reality there in marriage in terms of the trust, the security, the buy-in from friends and family, and also just people are much more likely to kind of make an effort when they're married versus when they're cohabiting. One concrete empirical indicator, I just read a study for a journal review, and they found that when it comes to predicting who marries whom, personality characteristics and looks are very important predictors of who marries whom. When it comes to cohabitation, they've got no predictive power at all. I mean, people just aren't being as sort of choosy about who they cohabit with, which I think you should bear in mind if you're entering into a cohabiting relationship.
A similar phrase that I found in some of the articles was shotgun wedding. The difference between a shotgun wedding versus cohabiting parents.
Well, we are seeing now today more shotgun cohabitations where people are getting together, they're living together in the wake of having a child together. We still see some shotgun marriages, although they're much, you know, much more infrequent than they used to be, of course. So there's something about having a kid that can lead some couples, be the unmarried or whatever, to, well, when they're unmarried, to either cohabit together or to get married. But of course, the best sequence, if possible, is to, and this is called the success sequence from a Paris College of Brookings, is to get your education, get a job, get married, and have kids in that order. If you do that, your odds of for instance, being poor are quite low.
But isn't, I guess my question to that would be, that's the expected route, whether it's correct or, I guess, and you're saying that it is successful, But is that because that's the way everyone does it?
Well, clearly everyone doesn't do it that way, you know, today. And that's the point, is that, you know,
that's a recent change. If you ask that in the 70s and possibly, sure. I would assume that sometime in the 80s, it may have begun to change a little bit. But is that, you know, everyone doesn't do it that way now.
Correct. Exactly. There's a lot of different routes that run into marriage and parenthood. And what I'm saying though, is that it makes sense. You know, for most people to sequence it, you know, where they have, once again, they have their education, their work, then their marriage, and then become parents together. They're much more likely to stay together, to be happy in their marriages, and to give their kids, you know, that stable context where the kids are more likely to flourish.
Professor Brad Wilcox, from the director of the National Marriage Project here on WNRN Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Call up with your question or comment, like Laura did, 979-0919-877-WNRN-ROCK. Professor, talking about, I guess, the successful route of doing things, how about diversity? I mean, is diversity better in terms of improving ways, finding ways that would be equally successful? But we haven't been allowed to be very diverse yet, because those who are making many of the decisions in regards to successfulness are still living and expecting the old ways.
Well, I mean, I would say, I mean, I'm not exactly sure where you're headed with this question, but I would just...
expecting the old guy with the gray hair determining where you get to go in terms of being given the promotion or elected into the school or things like that.
Yeah, I don't think that kind of diversity has much to do with you know, successful families. I think what we see is basically that kids are more likely to flourish when they have a stable home and when they have two parents who love them, who are dedicated to them, and who make it, you know, who make it work, you know, in their own marriage. And who are there for them. And that happens in all colors. It happens for African Americans, whites, Latinos, Asian Americans, et cetera. And the results are pretty clear that it doesn't matter what kind of, you know, outcome you're looking at, on average, kids are more likely to flourish when they have a stable two-parent home. This is not about diversity. It's just about common sense, is what I would say at the end of the day.
But if you are not given the promotion because you come from a not atypical family, if you... and other situations like that. So therefore that spreads down to your family because you are not as financially successful or educational, successful. So because someone else who's used to the routine can't accept someone who's not in the routine. And so that spreads down to your family.
You know, I think that concern would have been a valid concern maybe 40 years ago. But I think in this world, in this day, you know, in the vast majority of workplaces, you know, being a single parent, being a single person, being a married person doesn't have a tremendous bearing on whether you're hired or fired. And so the point I would make is that your odds of actually getting the education, for instance, that you would need to get the job of your desires, your dreams, is more likely to happen when you have got two parents at your back helping you to navigate schools and college compared to kids who don't have. So, I ask kids in my classes at UVA to raise your hands if you're from an intact two-parent family. And the clear majority of my kids at UVA raise their hands. What's the problem with that? Well, the problem with that is that most young adults their age can't raise their hands. So the point I'm making to you this morning is that, you know, if you're sort of fortunate enough to have two parents who stay together, you're more likely to be able to go to a school like UVA. If you're not fortunate enough to have that in your background, you're more likely, you know, to end up as a high school dropout or as a high school graduate with no college. So it's about, actually, in terms of, from my perspective, it's about trying to ensure that all kids have equal opportunities, to sort of ensure that diverse kids across the country are equally likely to go to school, go to college, and succeed in our country. And today that's not happening because, in part, not enough parents are able to get and stay married to give that context, that stable context, to their kids.
And that's causation, not association.
It's both. It's both a cause and consequence of increasing economic inequality in our country. And there's a great article in the National Journal on this very subject that was just published this past week.
And 11:35 on the Wake Up Call with our guest, Professor Brad Wilcox.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And support for WNRN comes from Blue Ridge Mountain Sports, celebrating 40 years as your local one-stop source for outdoor gear, apparel, and footwear. This holiday season, Blue Ridge has adventure gifts, including water bottles, multi-tools, backpacks, mitten gloves, and snow hats. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports is at Barracks Road in Charlottesville and at two locations in Richmond. For more information, it's brms.com. And at noon, Drew Thompson will be here for Les Temps Purdue. That's the best of 80s and 90s alternative. Drew will bring you the roots of alternative, because you can't understand where we are now without knowing first where we've been. Take a trip back to the times gone by with Les Temps Purdue, only on WNRN. Back with our guest, Professor Brad Wilcox, director of the National Marriage Project. Professor, let's talk about parenting for a little bit. Again, 979-0919. If you'd like to call in with a question or a comment, 877-WNRN-ROCKS. You had a an article that made me giggle just when I saw the title. If Mommy Ain't Happy. Talk about that article, about mom not being happy and how that affects the family.
Well, you know, the old conventional wisdom that if mama ain't happy, nobody ain't happy is true. And what we find basically is when women are happy in their marriages, they're more engaged mothers, they're happier mothers, and they're also better at doing discipline in their homes. So, you know, one of the key, I think, takeaway lessons here for all of us, you know, particularly for those of us who are husbands, is that we need to focus on making our wives happy in our marriages, in part just because that's going to have a big impact on the tone of the family more generally, and on our kids' welfare as well.
We were talking about earlier about challenges in the family in the modern day era. Is raising a family more difficult now, or what challenges, new challenges, different challenges does it provide because the script has changed, because the mother wants and expects to have fair social and work-related roles, but when they come home, still wants and is expected to provide much a greater percentage of the home life leadership?
Well, yeah, I think that one thing that we see in our most recent research is that equity is very important. So it's important for women to have a sense their husbands are fairly engaged in the life of the home. But it's also important to note that the most happy situation for women, the one that they prefer the most when they've got kids at home, is to be working part-time. We're only 20% of dads are reporting that as their kind of ideal strategy. So there is a sort of way in which people, they want a sense of equity in their marriages, but they also want, women want the opportunity to have a foot both in the work world and the family world, and more of a foot in the family than their husbands would want. So kind of how do that make sort of sense in the real world can be a challenge for ordinary couples in terms of how do we arrange things so that my wife, you know, is able to be engaged with the kids more than I am, and yet still have a foot in the work world. You know, what do I need to do on the home front to make that happen, but also on the work front too? So sort of navigating that work-family, that juggle is challenging, I think, for many couples.
But I have friends and family where the mother wants and expects to go to work and have the same role of leadership, the same role of responsibility and payment, and then come home and again, if I'm being a stereotype jerk, 979-0919, and then comes home and expects, expects isn't the wrong word, but sort of from within, the natural feeling is to be the leader at home. And so there's a greater percentage of tugging on both sides.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think women do have, are more likely to have sort of a divided heart between the work world and the home world. And that can lead to dilemmas for them both personally and then professionally, and also challenges in terms of navigating how that works, you know, for them in their marriage. I think your observation is correct. But what I want to stress too is that, and what is often, I think, lost in our discussions of this, is that the majority of married women would like to be working part-time or to be at home full-time, and a large minority of women would like to work full-time. So what we have in this country is that there's no one model of how you sort of combine work and family that captures the imaginations or the realities of most married moms today.
So the script, for that part, is no script. Still being written.
and every couple has to write the script differently, which is both a blessing and a curse at the same time.
A couple titles from things I found on the National Marriage Project webpage, nationalmarriageproject.org. I'd like to go through these. Parenthood makes life meaningful and how marriage makes parenthood bearable.
Right. So we've talked before today about how oftentimes couples experience a hit when the first baby comes along. You know, it's a big adjustment for everybody, including the couple and their families more generally. But we also see in the research that women and men, particularly women, are more likely to say their lives are meaningful when they have kids compared to those who don't have children. So you take a hit when it comes to your personal happiness when that first kid comes along. But you're also most more likely, on average, to see your lives as meaningful when that first, you know, when that first child comes along too.
Talk a bit about the making life meaningful part. You know, I have friends who are married without children, and they travel the world, and they have been able to find the jobs that they have most desired. And then I have friends who have children whose lives revolve around, and that may not be the best choice of words, but who can't do things because of the children and the needs that go along with raising children. So in some ways, it seems to me that those without children would have a very bearable life or meaningful life.
Well, you know, and I'm not the one who's giving these answers on these surveys, so I have to guess here. But I think it is. I mean, it certainly is the case that having kids oftentimes is more stressful, and does limit your capacity to do everything that the world presents to us. But there's something I think that's irreplaceable about, you know, holding an infant, you know, that's just been born in your hands, knowing that this little girl is your daughter, or you know, seeing your son ride a bicycle for the first time. Or, as was the case for our family once, you know, hiking, you know, through Yosemite Park and, you know, seeing a daughter manage to go up hundreds of steps, you know, at age five. I mean, these are kind of meaningful moments that are, you know, I can't compare to a professional accomplishment or to a great travel experience that I had before I had kids. So, you know, I think it's sort of these unique moments, sort of the sense of watching another human being that you've helped bring into this world, or adopted, for instance, you know, that these things are irreplaceable. And I think for many of us are more meaningful than our professional or our other kind of leisure accomplishments or experiences.
Well, let's talk about the state. And by state, I'm talking about the state of Virginia, the government state as a whole. Does the State of the Union have a role in marriage and childbearing? And I guess that's the wrong way to phrase it. What should the role be in marriage and childbearing?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There, you know, you probably have many good friends. You may enjoy playing tennis with them, hiking with them, listening to music together. But you don't go down and get a license, a friendship license for those friends. And I think the reason the state has a marriage license that it extends to people in general is because marriage is that institution which has, for you know, much of human history, been the institution that sort of stabilizes adult intimate sexual relationships and provides, more importantly, a stable context for any kids that come along from that relationship. So it's that connection to sort of having kids and raising kids that I think makes the state interested in marriage and in its relative success and stability. So I think that's why we should think about marriage as sort of as of concern to the state, and why the state of Virginia should, you know, sort of be concerned with how stable and successful the families are within the borders of the Commonwealth of Virginia.
I ask this next question to you not as the director of the National Marriage Project or as a representative of the University of Virginia, but as a professor who gets feedback from full classrooms of students. Do you have students, or what is the current student thought process on the state and its promotion of marriage and childbearing, because certainly you don't have to be very smart to see that over the last decade, the thought process on marriage is being argued by two certainly vocal sides.
Yeah, I mean, I think that young adults today, including young adults that I work with at UVA, are increasingly likely to get a broadly libertarian perspective on marriage and family life, and that is to sort of have the view that this is a kind of a private affair, and it's not, you know, really the state's business to be all that concerned with or all that involved with the family. I would also add, I think that's a mistaken view. And the reality is that if you spend any time in the courtroom or in the courts downtown Charlottesville, you know, there's a pretty busy family court and there's a pretty busy criminal court. And a lot of what happens both in the criminal court, what happens in the family court, has everything to do with families not functioning effectively. And so you've got, you know, kids who are cycling through the system. You've got the, you know, judges figuring out who's going to see which parent at what time. And you've got, unfortunately, a lot of young boys who are teenage boys, young men, who have been raised without a father and are much more likely to end up in jail or in prison as a consequence. So there's a certain naivete, I think, to what is the conventional wisdom out there among young adults today, and that is that the state doesn't have a real interest in the family, because, in fact, when families break down or don't form in the first place, courts and police officers and other agencies have to step into the breach and fix the mess that follows.
But would your students say that the government has a one-sided view of what the expected family, the script, and whether that is changing and change as it should?
Well, certainly a majority of the students in my class support same-sex marriage, for instance. But my broader point here is that I think, you know, also probably a clear majority of my students would have this view that it's really not the state's business to be really in the marriage business or to be concerned about what's happening with respect to marriage. And I think that's just a naive view, because it doesn't recognize the simple fact that anyone can see who spends any time near the courts in downtown Charlottesville, that when the family breaks down, whether it's through divorce or non-marriage, there's child support, there's, you know, child visitation, there's foster care, there's more, you know, more boys ending up in court and ending up in jail and prison, et cetera. So, you know, there's just a certain kind of, there's a mentality out there that's more libertarian, but I don't think it recognizes, as I said before, the fact that, you know, when people aren't doing well in their families, the state has to often step in, and that's unfortunate.
Should the state step in before there's a break in the family?
That's my point. It's the state should do more, I think, to try to secure a strong and stable foundation for families. And that's not just about the cultural script. It's also about trying to also, I think, improve, for instance, the state of vocational training, both here in the Commonwealth and then, of course, more generally. Because, for instance, most Americans, particularly most American men, will not get a college degree, and yet much of our focus when it comes to education is on higher education in the kind of conventional college university format. And if we did a better job, I think, for instance, of providing vocational training to our young adults, particularly to our young men, we'd be more likely to find good-paying jobs that will help prepare them for marriage and a good family life down the road.
11:50 here on the Wake Up Call, WNRN Charlottesville. Our guest today, Professor Brad Wilcox. He's the director of the National Marriage Project and author of When Marriage Disappears, The New Middle America. And let me thank L. Oppelman for their support today. Serving Lynchburg for 122 years. In addition to loans, L. Oppelman deals in jewelry, musical instruments, and game systems, plus TVs, cameras, and tools, with new inventory arriving every day. This holiday season, you can take advantage of L. Oppelman's layaway plan and get a head start on your Christmas list. That's L. Oppelman, 909 Main Street in downtown Lynchburg. Back with Professor Wilcox. Professor, let's talk a minute about religion and what role that plays in relationships, marriage, parenting. As we said several times now, the National Marriage Project is a nonprofit, and you said that the board members are from several religions, including agnostics. But the study, even though the studies may not be geared towards a specific religion or studies from the perspective of a specific religion, there must be lessons learned about how religion plays.
What we find in our research and the research of others is that when couples share a common religious faith, they're more likely to go the distance, they're more likely to be happy in their marriages, they're less likely to cheat on one another. But when couples don't share the same faith, we don't see those same kinds of benefits. So it's important when you talk about the, sort of the impact of religion on marriage to recognize it really depends on whether or not the couples are on the sort of the same page or the same team, to use that metaphor. And it's also important to recognize that, of course, you know, Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, Muslim couples have difficulties and challenges in their marriages. It's not like religion is just sort of like this magic cure-all for any kind of marital distress or any kind of life difficulty, but that on average it tends to give people a sense of a meaning, a purpose, a network of friends who are there for them when the going gets tough. And all these things, you know, help increase the odds that they'll succeed in their own marriages.
How about gender? Because I guess the, you know, we keep talking about script. The old script was that all the women wanted to get married and they had to go find their man and convince him that he needed to get married.
Well, it, you know, it's still the case that it looks like women are more likely to sort of be looking towards marriage, you know, in their early 20s and mid 20s, and that men are more likely to move in that direction in their mid and late 20s. So there is a kind of a difference in terms of when it happens. And I think oftentimes in a typical relationship, the woman is more likely to be thinking forward towards marriage. That's the average pattern. Of course, we all know many exceptions to that. What's also interesting, though, when it comes to the gendered script is that, although that's true still, I think, in many respects for who wants to get married, when it comes to who wants to leave the marriage, it's also the case women are more likely to want to leave the marriage first. Women are more likely to express an interest in getting divorced and are more likely to file for divorce than are men. And so this gendered story actually runs in different directions, I think, at the start and at the end of marriages. And I think both of
those... First one in, first one out?
Exactly. And but I think what's happening here in many cases is that women have a stronger orientation towards sort of the quality of the relationship and all the dynamics, for better and for worse, of the relationship. And they want to be in that intimate relationship, and they see marriage as sort of the capstone. But then when it's not sort of working out like they thought it might or they expected that it would, it's not kind of giving them the kind of intimacy and the kind of meaning that they had hoped that it would. I think they're more likely to seek an early exit that way too. So this the story about, you know, it's about gender and marriage, I think, is a more nuanced one than I think many people realize.
Let's chat for a minute about the holidays. I mean, you know, the two biggest holidays, at least family-wise, we seem to be between them. And people always make the joke about, oh, having to spend more time with the families. And I'm one of those people who adores the two holidays. My family doesn't live in the area. I get to go home and spend time with that, you know, those happy family memories, and they're still there. Talk about relationships and parenting during this holiday time.
Well, you know, I think the first thing to recognize is that it actually is, as everyone knows, it's pretty stressful between, you know, getting presents, making preparations for holiday celebrations, and then dealing too with, you know, there can be family tensions between, you know, mom and adult daughter, between grandpa and grandson, et cetera. So there's a lot of stress there. And so it's, you know, although I think we look forward to holidays like, you know, Christmas and Hanukkah and Thanksgiving, there's also a lot of stress that's associated with that, and that can be, you know, the downside. Another thing that I mentioned earlier, too, is that when people are on the same page, like religiously speaking, for instance, it's easier to navigate, you know, Christmas, you know, whereas if one spouse is celebrating Christmas and one spouse is celebrating Hanukkah, you know, that's more challenging as well. So, you know, I think the bottom line here is that holidays present opportunities, but also clear challenges too to families today.
Well, there's also, we can talk about the same page financially. I mean, it doesn't, you know, I come from a family. I have two sisters, so there's three of us on this level. Both parents are still alive. There's three, you know, grandchildren. It doesn't take much for someone to be on a different financial level and for that to play and have a negative impact as well, would it?
Are you saying a certain level of envy or jealousy or what exactly?
You could certainly talk about that.
Yeah.
Or the, you know, the uncle who never gives a good gift or who always gives, you know, awesome gifts. And yes, but, you know, let's talk about it from the envy standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously it's human nature that, you know, people Well, number one, that, you know, we live in a pretty mobile society. So across the generations, particularly, you know, as you get into the second generation, you're going to see, you know, grandkids as they enter into adulthood who are at very different places, you know, financially. But even among the adult children of, you know, that first generation, you know, certainly, you know, you see that in my family and other families where some kids have done extraordinarily well financially and some, you know, are just keeping their head above water financially. And I think there can be a sense of resentment if they feel like those who are kind of more at the lower end of the ladder feel like the wealthier siblings, you know, either aren't helping out if they're in some kind of distress or, you know, aren't really necessarily taking care of mom and dad, you know, the older parents, you know, as they enter into their old age and face their own challenges. So all these things can be fodder for family difficulties, certainly.
And I would think that at this, as our citizens get older in life, you know, it used to be that 70s was an old age, and now it's not unusual. My grandmother turned 90 just a couple months ago and still has the acuity to drive around town anywhere she'd like to go. But that's not always the case for everyone. Grandparents who are aging, and so now everyone comes back into town, and that may cause some family problems for those who are still around to take care of those folks and those who are just flying into town for the holiday.
Yeah, and one of the things we see now is sort of the sandwich generation where you've got young adults or middle-aged adults who waited to have kids into their 30s, and their kids are you know, maybe teens, but their parents now are entering into their, you know, that old age stage. And so they're sort of stuck taking care of teens and taking care of older parents at the same time. That can be enormously stressful. But one other wrinkle we haven't talked about, and this goes to the family diversity point also, is that for people whose parents have gotten divorced and then maybe have gotten remarried, you know, or have had more than one, you know, divorce and remarriage, you know, for them, holiday time can be really challenging, navigating different households, different schedules, different, you know, step-parents, et cetera. And we're seeing, of course, more and more of that around the holiday season today than we did 50 years ago because of the family changes that we've been talking about today. And that's just one more additional challenge facing middle-aged adults today.
And I bless my family for not giving me that. Professor Brad Wilcox, he's a UVA professor of sociology and director of the National Marriage Project. Now, Professor, I didn't ask you about this earlier, but the National Marriage Project report typically comes out in December, correct?
That's correct.
So we've seen 2010, 2011, 2012 coming
out
this upcoming week.
Yes, next week.
Any tidbit you can give us about what might be on there?
It's sort of a bipartisan agenda for what we can do to strengthen marriage in Middle America, the things we're talking about today.
All right, that leaves us with about a minute and a half, so I'm going to ask this question. One of the things that caught my eye was, do date nights improve relationships?
And the short answer is yes. Basically, people are looking for opportunities to experience some romance, some novelty, a time to reconnect. And so we, you know, counsel couples, particularly when they have kids in the household, to make time to get out and have their own dates. That's a sort of a great opportunity to put aside the stresses of parenting and, you know, the finances and all that kind of thing, and to reconnect and rekindle that love that will sustain them for the distance.
Greater detailed information, nationalmarriageproject.org. We'll put this show up on podcast for those of you who only heard about parenting and relationships for a part of the hour. Professor, thank you for coming in today.
Rick, it's a pleasure to be on WNRN.
Well, thank you for listening. Thank you for joining us this Sunday. We'll be here next week with David Toscano. He's the House Democratic leader in the Virginia General Assembly and the Charlottesville area representative. Thank you.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@aol.com or wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Angie Cruz. Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.